Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. An old farmer trying to build a plane in his village. A young man that gambles everything on the roaring stock market. A community transformed by a magical fruit that evokes vivid memories. A Chinese woman unable to understand her American partner. And people stuck in a train station, waiting for a train that never comes. These stories, among others, make up Land of Big Numbers, the debut story collection by Tuping Chen. Chen's fiction spans a wide array of styles and narratives, from vignettes that feel like they could have been plucked from the newspapers, through surreal allegories for Chinese society, to character examinations of cross-cultural relationships. Tuping Chen is a fiction writer and journalist. She is a Wall Street Journal correspondent in Philadelphia who was previously based in Beijing and Hong Kong. Her fiction has been published in The New Yorker, Granta, and Tin House. Today, Tuping and I talk about the different stories in Land of Big Numbers and her choice of styles, narratives, and themes. We'll talk about how these stories are based on her time in China, as well as the differences between writing for fiction and writing for journalism. So, Tuping, thank you so much for joining me today. I wanted to talk about, maybe first, the story collection as a whole. As I noted in the intro, it covers a wide array of styles, a wide array of themes and narratives, from allegories for Chinese society to, you know, close examinations of cross-cultural relationships. What kind of connects these various stories, and what was your decision in terms of collecting them together in one collection?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on. I'm really excited to be here and get to share about the book. The stories, of course, are most obviously connected by China. All of them are either set in China or are feature Chinese protagonists also in the US as well. Beyond that, I think there are a lot of themes too that just arose very naturally out of my years living in China and that come through in the book too. These questions, you know, about what it means to live in a society of 1.3 billion people and how you try and find a sense of identity and meaning, even in a society where often you're living under tremendous constraints and where you're also often presented with moral dilemmas, which characters in the book encounter in a variety of ways. And, you know, that takes the form of everything from, you know, a young woman, a promising student who decides to kind of give up that more promising academic path to become an online activist of sorts, to, you know, people who are, you know, retired men and women who are in and out of love and trying to just essentially make lives for themselves, even in, sometimes incredibly difficult circumstances.
I know this is probably a hard question because there's, you know, I'm sure you're fond of every story in this collection, but I wonder if you could kind of talk us through maybe one or two of the stories from the collection that are perhaps your favorites.
Sure, yeah. So my favorite story in the collection is Flying Machine, which is tells the story of a rural inventor, and he's living in the countryside, and he has previously invented, readers learn, a robot that makes noodles, which was a detail I was really delighted to get to work into that story, because it's actually one based on a story that I wrote for the Wall Street Journal about this trend in China of robot waiters as well as robot chefs that were being used in a number of restaurants as cost-saving and labor-saving devices. And also, as well, that is one story that is very much kind of plucked from the headlines. The second thing that readers see him inventing or trying to invent is an airplane, which was a headline I remember reading as a reporter in the local press, just seeing, and not just on one occasion, but multiple occasions of reading about these farmers who were trying to build airplanes in the countryside. And it just seemed like kind of a magical and just very strange, surprising thing. And that just sort of seized my imagination. And so readers encounter, you know, they'll meet the character who I imagined lay behind some of these stories. I never actually got to go out and write that story for perhaps not surprising for an American newspaper. It wasn't exactly a news story, but it seemed like such a human story and a really compelling one. And so I loved getting to write that story, which to me embodies, you know, there's a lot of tenderness in that story and also a sense of, you know, you meet this character, Cao Cao, this elderly farmer who's building this airplane, who has never been on an airplane, but has this incredible ambition. And he's very much in earnest about it. And that to me, you know, really speaks, the story speaks a lot about that side of China that I love so much, you know, which is so, you know, you meet so many people like Cao Cao and which were incredibly ambitious, but also have like this wonderful pragmatism too. You know, he decides he wants to fly. And so he rolls up his sleeves and tries to build an airplane.
So I hadn't realized, I think, until after I finished the book, that some of these stories are based off of real stories you wrote for the Wall Street Journal. Other than Flying Machine, what are the other stories that are based off of your reporting in China?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess you couldn't quite say that they're based on the reporting. Just more that there were images or motifs that I did encounter in my reporting that made their way into stories, and sometimes it was in little details, like, for example, the noodle making robots, or elsewhere in that story, funeral strippers, which was another detail that I'd run into as a reporter, this phenomenon of strippers at funerals, you know, in which someone dies, and then you decide, you know, you want to ensure good turnout, and so you decide to hire a stripper. That was another detail that was very much something that was kind of something I'd encountered as a reporter and just thought was so fascinating and wanted to put into a story. And so there were little details like that that are studied throughout the book. And as well, you know, I think some of the questions also underlying stories like Lulu, which opens the collection and, you know, tells the story of these two twins that take these divergent paths, including the young woman who becomes kind of this online activist and citizen journalist who ends up in jail. I mean, that's not one that was directly inspired by any one particular story, but is absolutely the kind of story that I would run into frequently as a reporter there.
So these stories, they're short vignettes. In fact, I think none of them actually have the main, you know, tension be resolved. Why did you decide to write the stories in this way, to kind of leave out any kind of conclusion? And I guess, was it difficult for you as the writer to sometimes leave the reader hanging with some of these questions?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I think that to me, I mean, what I love so much about the short story form in a lot of ways is you do get this window into someone's life, right? That is meaningful and important and pregnant with possibilities. And it's like taking a snapshot. And I think for me, I would write the stories, of course, you know, they necessarily sort of have an ending that I think as you identify, you know, often doesn't tie everything up in a neat bow, because A, I think that's often not how life is. And then B, also too, I think part of it too is wanting, I think, the reader to also, you know, sort of sink into the story and project forward too, like, you know, engage in a way that asks questions like, you know, here, meet, you know, a young man who's investing in the stock market and has found himself in the situation. And, you know, where do you, like, at the end, we're left, we see him facing the situation in a moment. And I think the way that, you know, the reader ends up having to answer questions sometimes that are raised by stories, and in some ways implicate himself in stories or herself in stories too, I think can be a powerful thing that short stories do. Just they really are, you know, you're pulled in into this whole world that gets built very quickly. And then I think sometimes like it's that feeling of returning back to your own reality that can also be powerful, and the juxtapositions too between the stories, and which is not to say that I didn't know necessarily how the stories ended. I mean, even when I wasn't necessarily leading the reader directly there or saying, you know, epilogue, this is what happened. I in a number of them did, you know, even write endings for them, and know where a character wound up, but didn't actually, you know, spell it out quite so literally for the reader.
So now I like to talk about some of the, I guess, go a bit deeper into some of the stories and some of the things that kind of connect them throughout the collection. My first question is that several of the stories deal with cross-cultural relationships. In fact, the parallel I draw is between Beautiful Country, which features a Chinese woman and an American man, and then Field Notes on a Marriage, which features a non-Chinese woman and a Chinese man. I guess how does your exploration of these kind of cross-cultural relationships, first of all, what prompted that exploration? And then also, how does that exploration change depending on, I guess, your decision on the protagonist?
Yeah. You know, I wanted to write those stories. So those two are the ones that are set or feature more prominently sort of American characters. And I think for me, I mean, so many of these stories, you know, they weren't necessarily, I didn't set out necessarily with a particular XYZ that I wanted to impart, but it was something that fascinated me about a particular voice or even a situation. And so the story kind of unraveled from there. In the case of Field Notes on a Marriage, it actually started from a very particular place. I was, I recall, you know, throughout my time in China, being struck by the prevalence of these Chinglish signs, which, you know, you encounter them in museums or on the street, and sometimes very involved, long ones, in the case of museums, that they would almost read like poetry. And I kept imagining, you know, like the voice of a character who was encountering these and had the sense of bafflement and also delight, and trying to imagine who is this woman, like where has she come from? And so, and as I wrote the story, just, you know, creating this backstory for her. Okay, well, so she was an anthropologist in America who had been married to a Chinese man, and their relationship had fallen apart, and now she's in his home country trying to make sense and of this situation, and finding, you know, as you identify, like often just realizing the extent of the challenge of the gaps in knowledge of another person, and not to mention another culture. And I think, to me, like even though, I mean, those are some of the stories in the book that most clearly are talking about cross-cultural misunderstandings, I suppose you could say. But to me, I mean, I think they really are so much just really fundamentally about what it's like to be a person, you know, in that story, in love with another person, but not quite understanding them. And in others, you know, having your own, like in Beautiful Country, for example, you know, meeting a young Chinese woman living abroad in Arizona and on a road trip with her lover, and finding a lipstick in his car that doesn't belong to her, and knowing that, you know, it means something, but not wanting to believe it. I just, you know, I think there are all those, I guess what fascinated me about those relationships and was just, I mean, I think there are absolutely miscommunications in the ways that we project desire onto each other and try and understand each other and often fall short. But I think in so many ways, like those are just human kind of hits and misses. And I think the background of being Chinese versus American, I think that's there too. But ultimately, I think so much of the gaps that you see in those stories fundamentally are just like ones that are the product of being two people who are not the same.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I'd like to talk now about a couple stories I think relate to, I'm going to say, digital technology, but maybe more how people interact with the digital space. I'm specifically thinking of Hotline Girl, with the character who works in the government satisfaction hotline, and Land of Big Numbers, which is obviously about a retail investor playing in with the stock market. I think one might be tempted to kind of see these as, oh, these are indicative of what tech and the interactions with technology are like in China. Do you see these as discussions of what it's like in China to interact with technology, or I guess with these spaces, or are they kind of talking more about universal phenomenon? Maybe I think in some ways talking about the ups and downs of the stock market, it's pretty hard to say that's only a Chinese phenomenon after the whole, you know, GameStop, you know, ups and downs.
Sure. Yeah. I think in those stories, I mean, broadly throughout the collection, I think I was really interested in my time in trying to see how technology shaped society and your own, just like the texture of your daily life, right? And so, and of course, often through your phone, or as we see in Hotline Girl, through screens in a more public way. That really fascinated me. I think so the two stories that you mentioned with Hotline Girl, I think you see it, technology shaping this young woman's life in a more political way. So for folk who haven't read the book, it's set in a near futuristic sort of city that's similar to Beijing. And she's a young government bureaucrat working at a call center, a satisfaction center dedicated to dealing with citizen complaints, which, since you're asking before, is one of the details that was definitely inspired by my time as a reporter, just running across references to these sorts of government centers, which I thought were so fascinating. Anyway, it always really struck me living in China, just how much, just what a media saturated environment was, with especially the sorts of messages that you would get from state media, which were often these like really cheerful, chirpy bulletins, which functioned to, you know, remind you about either health tips issued in like this very grandmotherly way, or sometimes it was things like cute kittens, but just like a constant stream of these sorts of viral kind of news blips, or that kind of content that to me was often just like at really jarring odds with the actual day-to-day experience and sometimes very harsh realities around you. And so that's what you see in Hotline Girl, very much like that sense of juxtaposition and you know, these omnipresent screens that are issuing these kinds of bulletins, these chirpy bulletins that are at odds with what, as readers, we learn to see more about this environment and what is in fact more disturbing and lies underneath the surface. So, but then in a story like Land of Big Numbers, where we meet this government bureaucrat who gets very caught up in the stock market and investing through apps on his phone. I mean, to me, I think that speaks to another side of technology, just the way, like kind of the gamification in some ways of life that is by no means unique to China. And of course, is in his case, I mean, leads to the sense of, money, I think, for that character was always something that seems sort of fictional, and because he wasn't raised with wealth, and so it seems like something that's so intangible to him, and that is just, of course, augmented by the sense of it all happening on his phone, and that the sense of giddiness and the sense of it not being bound by gravity, and I think, yeah, and a sense of addiction too, which I think is something that's really relatable to people, even though who haven't necessarily experienced like GameStop or like Jufeng gotten caught up in the currents of the Chinese stock market. And I think that gamification feeling and also the corresponding feeling of hollowness too, that can accompany, our really close, just the intermingling of technology in our lives and our ambitions. You see that too in a story like Lulu, right? Where the character, the title character ends up becoming very much drawn into the internet and using it as a political tool. And also her brother, who was drawn into the internet in a very different way, in a much more consumerist way, and becomes this professional online video gamer. Just that I think, you know, of course, there are stark contrasts in all these journeys. But I think what spoke to me in the writing of these stories was also this feeling that there was a shared undercurrent of this, of the internet just exerting this incredibly strong pull on people. And also at times, you know, just like the feeling of addiction, and also a feeling of doubt too, in what just, you know, this, we see it act in really different ways in these different characters' lives. And I think ultimately, like, it's such a powerful thing, and it also can be such a lonely thing.
One more question about the stories in the collection. There are a couple surreal or more surreal stories. As if you're thinking about New Fruit and Gube Ko Spirit, you know, one might be tempted to read these stories as allegories for sentiments in Chinese society. But in making the choice to kind of write these more surreal vignettes, what were the kinds of messages or themes you were trying to convey?
Yeah. You know, I think they didn't start out necessarily as me, you know, wanting to convey XYZ message again. I think, because, you know, ultimately I wanted the book to just to be stories that can transport mm-hmm. readers and entertain readers. And to me, I think some of the questions that animate the story, so I mean, they're definitely, I think there are political allegories, both the stories that you mentioned, but also for me, the ideas that behind them, you know, the idea of a supernatural fruit that comes into a neighborhood and transforms people's relationships and lives the way we see in New Fruit, or the idea of these commuters who get ludicrously stuck underground on a subway platform for months on end for purely bureaucratic reasons. I mean, to me, those sorts, like the extremities of those stories, in many ways was me trying through fiction to evoke some of the absurdities and extremities of life in Chinese society, where so much, I think, of life does have that surrealist edge and the sense that, you know, really anything could happen and often does happen. And that's something that can be magical at times, surprising and delightful, right? And I think for any of your listeners who have spent time living in the mainland, like, life can be peppered with all those sorts of, you know, surprises, like, say, for example, in this book, an elderly farmer who's building an airplane from scratch. And we see that in New Fruit, where the fruit first begins life in a certain way and elicits this feeling of delight and joy, and over time becomes something more sour. Literally, not literally, but in terms of the emotional journey for the locals in Beijing who are eating it. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that was one impulse that was driving the writing behind the stories. But you're absolutely right. I mean, they absolutely did become, in many ways, sort of political fairy tales or allegories. And I think that's particularly true of Gube Ko Spirit, which, you know, tells the story of these commuters who get stuck underground and become sort of prisoners of the Beijing subway system. And to me, it was, you know, as I was writing it, I mean, it did start, of course, with this feeling, which, you know, of me one day sitting on a subway and looking around and thinking, you know, what would happen if we got stuck, and wondering what would unfold from there and how quickly social norms would break down, and just, like, literally what sort of society would we form. And yeah, and just thinking through some of those questions as I was writing it. But also, that story wound up, to me, being, you know, written in many ways as trying to wrestle with the question of, you know, what it is like to live in an authoritarian society where so many of your choices are constrained, and where at the same time, though, there are many things that are working to make you comfortable within the system. And so in Gube Ko Spirit, that takes the form of state propaganda and how these passengers who get stuck underground end up becoming lionized by state media. And we see them also, you know, having many creature comforts delivered through donations that flood in. And so, and on the one hand, it's like quite literally a story of people get stuck underground. It's a story about, like, public transportation and this, you know, the Beijing subway system, which always fascinated me living there, just as this, like, symbol of modernity, and also one that authorities have worked for so long to try and, in many ways, quote unquote, civilized. That was it. That was one story I actually did write when I was with the journal. Was a story about a competition that authorities had launched to try and find, you know, the most civil, quote unquote, civilized subway passengers, just part of a sort of this extended history in Beijing of the government doing things like, you know, launching these public propaganda campaigns, like with penguins motifs to try and get people to line up, or playing classical music to try and make people act in more refined ways while riding the subway. Anyway, all this is true, which I thought was fascinating. But I think this, you know, over the arc of the story, like, we see how people ultimately, like, they first find themselves in this incredibly repressive situation, but over time grow more comfortable. I think for when speaking with friends back home in the States, and especially since coming back to the States, while I was living in China, I mean, that was something that always struck me, was this sense that, of really bafflement from friends in the States, asking, what is it like to live in a society as repressive as China? The sense that it was really like this bleak, 1984 kind of experience, and trying to explain this Gubaekip spirit in many ways is my attempt to try and really paint a different picture of what it is like and can be like, and often is like, for many Chinese, in which it really is, it's a world where the easiest thing in the world is actually to become quite comfortable and to accept the realities at hand.
So one final question, and it's based on the fact that you're both an accomplished author of fiction and an established journalist. Do you think that, how is being a journalist affected your experience as an author? Or perhaps do you look at journalism differently after becoming a writer of fiction?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think I look at journalism differently since writing fiction. I will say, for me, I think the two have always gone hand in hand. I love journalism, and, in my time as a reporter for the Journal, just getting to travel all through China and speak to so many different kinds of people, and just, to have that kind of insatiable curiosity and be allowed to exercise it, felt like an incredible privilege, and all the more so now, given how my colleagues have since been kicked out of the country, along with many other reporters from major American newspapers. And so, I guess if anything, looking back now, I just feel really grateful for the chance to have written the book. It really, just to think of how extraordinary a chance it was. I think the ways that being a journalist inflected my fiction writing, for me, it was really with Land of Big Numbers. It was just this feeling of having spent years in a country where my job was to try and convey truths about the world to readers far away, and feeling like so often the substance of what, we could write about, whether it was like the trade war or, Chinese state policy and all this really macro level stuff, really felt so often like it was only capturing like a fraction of, the immense complexity of society there, but also what made it compelling and like what made it so such a really extraordinary place to live, right? And like to get to meet people who just on a daily level really astounded me with inventiveness and creativity and passion and ingenuity in ways that I think were just, and humor too, right? And also like a sense of play, which readers encounter in this book, which I think can be hard to see from a distance, and especially hard perhaps to see through headlines, but is so much of what makes modern China what it is, and for me made it home and made me truly love the country, despite its government, and despite, of course, all of the frustrations that come with life there. But it's just, it is a place that I think for me, it just like I felt, as a reporter, I was constantly taking notes and being struck by what was around me. There's this quote by Carlos Fuentes, which I always return to, extreme attention is the creative faculty and its condition is love. And for me, that is journalism. Of course, is paying attention, but also as a fiction writer too, I think is this feeling of just looking around and seeing what's around you as meaningful and vivid and important. And for me, seeing it a million times over and just wanting to share it in whatever vehicle I could. And so fiction ultimately became that for me. Land of Big Numbers, of course, is the results. But I think for me, just underlying both the fiction and the journals was just feeling like constantly that there were a million stories that demanded telling and wanting to try and share.
So with that, that ends our interview with Teping Chen, author of Land of Big Numbers. One actual final question. Teping, what's next for you and where can people find your work?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So I'm still working full-time for the Wall Street Journal, and I'm still writing fiction, and including something that is not set in China, which is exciting, though it's been harder, of course, with everything being harder now with the pandemic. But that'll be something to stay tuned for, hopefully. And if readers want to find me, I'm at T-E-P-I-N-G Chen on Twitter. And then also my website is just myname.com.
You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at Nick R.I. Gordon. That's N-I-C-K-R-I-G-O-R-D-O-N. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at newbooksnetwork.com. We hope you subscribe and continue listening to the Asian Review of Books podcast, now on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, and share us with your friends who want to support us continuing to interview those writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned for more information soon on who's coming up next on the podcast. But before then, Teping, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.